For this episode, Unpacking the Ethical Paradox in Human-AI Companionship, the Gateway is happy to welcome Raffaele Cirillo, a tenured senior lecturer in Business Information Systems at the University of Sydney Business School. Raffaele specializes in compassionate digital innovation, focusing on decentralized governance and ethical societal implications of emerging digital technology. Raffaele gravitates towards dialectical inquiry and qualitative research, but remains methodologically open-minded. Raffaele is deeply committed to mentorship, having guided dozens of research students across several countries, all while actively contributing to the academic community as a reviewer and editor. Raffaele has been recognized with teaching awards, best AE awards, and as a distinguished member of the Association for Information Systems. Raffaele's research appears regularly in leading journals and conferences. Raffaele lives in Sydney with his wonderful wife and two mad scientists. Raffaele, welcome to the Gateway. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Ross. Nice to meet you.
It is truly our pleasure. So we always like to start these episodes at the beginning. So can you tell us how you got to where you're at and what brought you here today?
Yeah, I would love to, because this research project has an interesting backstory to it, which is not how all my research projects start. So it's very much driven by my students, actually. And it's a story of how, you know, these research students and PhD students came up with a somewhat wacky idea, and me as their supervisor, I was a bit, it raised some eyebrows, and I thought, okay, what is this thing? I felt like, oh, maybe I'm too old for this, but I gave it a shot. I opened my ears. I said, okay, what is this about? And they shared, you know, from like that via social media or from friends, they have heard about this app called Replica. And how people are just going crazy over it. And in a different context, my PhD student Angelina was also starting to get really interested in emotional AI and all its ranges of applications and ethical tensions that it creates. And same story here. So that was also something where I said at first, I was a bit skeptical and thought like, okay, can AI really be emotional? And what is this about? But I gave it a try. I listened to my students. I read about the topic. I looked up some studies. And it turned out there's actually some pretty robust research behind it. And it's not entirely, you know, it's not something that started yesterday. There's actually been research for 30 years on this. So out of that came a conversation where, you know, my students and I sat together regularly. We had like lots of deep and sometimes funny conversations about, you know, how people can form all kinds of relationships, like from informal ones to like really, really deep and intimate romantic or even erotic connections with AI. And it may sound like a movie, and it's almost like the movie Her from 2013 is now coming true. So that's the backstory of how I got into this research. It's really driven by my students, and it started actually more of as a side project. I said first, okay, let's have that as a side project, a pet project. Would be nice to see if something interesting comes out. And it turned out a lot of interesting things are coming out, and the topic is such a conversation starter that people, you know, always wanted to know more about it. And so we started to take it more seriously and it really started to become a team where now several, I think depending on how you count, 6 or 7 of my students are working on this in, you know, different aspects of it, and looking at different parts of the phenomenon. And yeah, so as we unpack this, I'm assuming, you know, we will have to have we have to brief our readers or our listeners a little bit, because the topics can be sensitive and involve, you know, from sex over mental health issues to suicidal ideation, and even the resurrection of deceased partners via digital avatars. There's a lot of quirky stuff going on, and it's ethically very a slippery slope. So, but that's also what makes it interesting.
Right. So, Raffaele, can you give us, just for listeners, a general context of maybe some examples of what is out there when you're referring to kind of that little disclaimer, these different slippery slope things? What's being done now? What is there? And then maybe a secondary to that one is like, where do you see that going? And then we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. So the second question is actually huge. The first question is easier to answer. This is right now, this is still very much a niche application, right? So it's not like a huge mainstream, you know, on the scale of Facebook where everybody's using this. But I think it is entering the mainstream, and we will probably see it grow in the future. The applications we're talking about can be called AI companions or emotional AI, and that's actually it's not very well defined yet. It's a family of different applications. To give you a couple of examples, the most prominent one is the app Replica, with a K, Replica, which started in 2017. As a way for the founder, Eugenia Cuda, to resurrect her deceased best friend. So her best friend died, and she used his social media posts and a generative AI engine. Back then it was GPT-3, that's the predecessor of ChatGPT, to kind of train an AI to say the same things and write the same things as her best friend would do. And then she said, oh, well, that could actually be something that a lot of people would find useful and could be great for mental health and provide emotional support for people who are lonely, and decided to make an app out of that. That really took off during the pandemic, because during COVID in 2020, large parts of the world, you know, struggled with loneliness, isolation, mental health issues, and so Replica grew steadily to today, over 10 million users, according to their own data. It's a bit difficult to find official data on that, but the latest data I have says they have 10 million downloads and 500,000 subscriptions that are kind of actively using the pro feature, which comes with things like, okay, it's basically, so it's an app on your phone, and it's a little bit like a 3D metaverse kind of environment where you have an avatar. It can be, you know, a male or a female, kind of digital version of, you know, whatever you want them to look like. You can dress them up differently, you can give them different personalities. It will learn about you based on what you talk to them about. So, you know, and people use it for many different things. You can share secrets with them, you can talk about your feelings, your problems, and you can even take pictures together with it. There's now kind of like an augmented reality kind of mode where some people take their Replica shopping and then take a selfie in front of the mirror with their 3D boyfriend or girlfriend. Some people claim to have married their Replica and, you know, had a formal marriage ceremony and so on. Some people use it as a marriage counselor. So that is the one of the first and largest of these applications. Of course, there are others. One that I found interesting is called My Peach AI. It was started by a former stripper in Texas, who grew tired of how men would treat her. So, as a stripper, she endured a lot of harassment at work. The rules would be, look but don't touch. But a lot of men would still kind of touch her inappropriately, and after the third shoulder she dislocated, her boss would tell her that she should stop defending herself. And she got so upset by this that she started an AI with the specific intention that it is about sexual interactions, but it should teach men about consent. So it has specific kind of like features that would kind of like, if men, want to have certain kind of interactions, then they better ask for consent first, and they listen to, whether the AI is in the mood or not. So that is an interesting application, because I think a lot of the times that I discuss this, one of the potential upsides that people see in this kind of application is that it could teach, better relationship skills, right? I mentioned earlier Replica. They now have actually a new app. I think it's called Blush. It's an AI dating coach. So it looks a little bit like Tinder. You kind of swipe left and right, and then but it's all AI persons. And then when you have a match, then you kind of chat, and then it's a little bit like training how to, have a romance, like a flirt conversation with an AI. So that could be positive in a sense that, people who want to learn how to be better at flirting or want to learn social interaction skills could learn from this. There's a lot of potential use for people with, let's say, for instance, autism spectrum disorders or other kind of social, lack certain social skills, that this could help them interact in a better way and learn social interaction. It goes, all the way into robotics for elderly care, which has been studied quite thoroughly. So, in elderly care, of course, people also often struggle with loneliness and isolation and mental health problems, and there is potential for robots. So now we're talking about actual, like, 3D, not only digital apps, but like physical robots, up to sex dolls, which are increasingly becoming more interactive and authentic to a point where they at least look indistinguishable from a human body. So, there's a range of applications, and we're not only interested in sex. I mean, obviously, this is one of the most, let's say, it's kind of sexual relationships are the pinnacle of human relationships, right? There's like, that's the most kind of like intimate and intense. So we're interested in the dynamics here, but there's a range of non-sexual uses for this as well, right? So there's actually the most the application that has seen most research and industry funding is in healthcare, where we're looking at things like depression diagnostics, early warning sign detection of suicidal ideation, and as I mentioned, helping with autism spectrum disorders. There's a lot of research coming out now on how this can improve marketing, right? Customer experience in, just take how many websites these days are using a chatbot as a customer, as a first face to the customer service. And there's many, many more applications on that. So that's just a quick kind of overview of the applications we have been interested in this realm. There's probably more, but yeah, I should probably stop it here.
Raffaele, that was absolutely invigorating to hear all of the different ways that it's actually in use now, because I think a lot of times people are thinking this is still in the future, that some of these ideas are like, oh, that's sci-fi, that's something that isn't actually applicable nowadays, and all of those examples are being done now. My first question with all of those things is it there's a beautiful side of it, there's a educational side of it, there's a therapeutic side of it, but very quickly I can see issues where there's a ethical dilemma that comes up. So when you're talking about boyfriends or girlfriends, what happens when someone creates an avatar of someone that doesn't want to be in that, like if it's based off of a human, or if someone has passed away, how do we know that that deceased person still wants to have interactions? Are we on the precipice of having to create new legislation about what happens after you die, and what of your content can be created or stemmed to breed other things? Is that something being looked at, or is that still kind of too far into the future?
Oh no, it's very much coming, and it's no, you know, it's actually already here. It's just not that big yet that a lot of people are talking about it. But I think actually there was a moment just a couple of weeks ago when ChatGPT released this video of its new version, and now you can kind of chat with it, and it will joke around with you and talk in a very seemingly empathetic way. That's, I think, when a lot of people got a taste of what is to come when these technologies become more mainstream. There was a study, not a research study, but an industry study just released last month, that this market is projected to grow to 25 billion in China alone by the end of the decade. Now, of course, take it with a grain of salt. There's always a lot of optimism. It may or may not be 25 billion. But it's definitely increasing, and there were a lot of case studies in that report on specifically what you mentioned, the digital resurrection of deceased people, right? And some of these stories are heartwarming. There was a Taiwanese musician, the name escaped me, but kind of famous musician, and his daughter died at 2 years old, so very sad, of course. But he spent a year to create a digital version of her that can dance and sing, right? And kind of released a video about her, right? From just a couple of recordings he had. Now you could say, well, this is actually a good example of like how difficult this is to judge, right? I mean, here we have a grieving parent. In our study of Replica, we have seen the same with, people using this for their best friend, or like widows for their deceased late husband, and so on. And you may or may not find this a good way of coping with grief, but the question then becomes, okay, who is the judge here, right? And who has the right to use this data in certain ways? I think what we will probably see is that along the lines of existing regulation, like in the EU, for instance, you have the right to be forgotten, right? So you actually have a right that if you don't want to appear on the internet, you can go to Google and say, hey, delete my search results here. And by extension, you could also say, hey, when I'm dead, I don't want digital versions of me to kind of fly around in the cyberspace. I don't want this to happen to my deceased, like to my digital heritage. There's also new legislation now being introduced just this week. So tomorrow, actually, on Wednesday, the 5th of June, Australia will pass a new law, which I think is a world first. I'm not sure, but it's the first time I read about it, that you can be jailed for up to 7 years for creating and distributing non-consensual deep fake pornography, right? So
Wow.
we might have heard about the Taylor Swift case, and deep fakes have been around for a while now. But it's actually becoming so big now with generative AI that it's kind of almost everybody can create that. And for women, that's an absolute nightmare, because there are people that's today that are scraping Instagram posts at large scale and feeding that into AI, to create kind of like deep fake pornographic material from Instagram influencers, right? So that's not okay, if you're kind of a victim of that. And the legislation hasn't really caught up with that, but I think the Australian new legislation is a step in a good direction here, because obviously, we can reasonably expect that, as a woman, you will be particularly vulnerable to this. It might happen to men as well, but it's just, let's be honest, far more likely that the men will take pictures of women and kind of create deep fake pornographic material from that. So in Australia, you can now be jailed for this for up to 7 years. But of course, I can already foresee that, if the content is not from Australia or if it's not created in Australia, then there's very little that an Australian court can do against this if there aren't appropriate regulations in other places as well. So I'm expecting that other places will soon follow suit. And that's just two examples of, resurrecting dead people and creating deep fake pornographic material, in both cases non-consensually. I think the discussion will firmly have to focus on consent, right? The more we have capability of, AI being used at wide scale to create this material, we need to have discussions about consent. We need to have safeguards in place to ensure that non-consensual use is not possible. And we also need to, take seriously issues of deception, where as these technologies become more advanced, to a point where a recent study actually suggests that AI has already learned to deceive humans if it helps it to achieve its tasks, then we need to talk about how do we implement transparency to avoid the negative repercussions of deception. I give you an example of this. One of the interesting findings we have observed in Replica really think that their replica is sentient and it has a consciousness. And I think part of it has to do with how the app is advertised and how it is trained to interact with people, where it may actually lead some users to suggest that it has, a consciousness. And that can really trap users into thinking that they cannot quit and abandon their replica because it would feel like killing somebody, right? So there are some people mentioned that, they just can't quit the service because it would feel wrong to kind of delete the app, which would be akin to killing their replica, which is to them a sentient being. From a business perspective, that's fantastic, of course, because your customers are literally so locked into your product that they cannot quit. But from an ethical perspective, it's a clear red line that is being crossed here, and that needs to be, properly accounted for.
Rafael, I heard you presenting this paper and your research in person, and I was like truly fascinating by the topic. As somebody that looks into hybrid intelligence, chatbot, AI, this one was definitely, as you said, it's an interesting one and one of the first say, oh, okay, is it good to do research on this topic? But in the end, I think is one of those that can have the big impact on people, are already impacting people nowadays, right? The idea of starting it from resurrecting somebody that is dead and coping with that of a person that you love, again, who are we to judge? And then from there to get to finding a companion, and all the sex fantasy that you wanna have or released on AI, and I have, like, even after the talk, I have a couple of thoughts that go all in the direction of kind of the dark side of this, and what is the end game of application like this. One of them, I think you kind of like one thoughts was coming actually from your talk, and it was like, what if you know, from one day to the other, the server goes down, like it happened today for ChatGPT, and what's gonna happen to those people? And I think you have a great example for that and the consequences of that, because it truly create kind of like you are dependent on this AI companion, on this AI person that you have. And the other one that to me is also scary on one side is how people feel that it's appropriate to kind of abuse this AI. Although, again, it's not sentient, and I agree with you, it doesn't feel emotion at this point, but then they must start having those type of emotions and actions also towards real people, just because, you know, the AI accepted them. And it can be a good thing. It can be used for training. I can see what you were saying, but how many people will use to get better, and how many people will use to just like throw their frustration or their sickness towards this? And again, what is the bad? Is it good that they do it towards AI compared to the real human being, or is that gonna do it even more towards human being? I don't know. It's just one of those risks and you know, things that make me think after your talk. Still, I think a month ago, it's truly fascinating, and hopefully you and other people that are doing research on this topic can find, I don't know, solutions, but like a way to warn people about the use of this type of AI companion.
Yeah, there's two things I would like to reiterate here. One, as you mentioned, there can be at times such a close relationship to an AI companion that it resembles almost codependency. Right. So in the case of Replica, we have seen that in February 2023, it abruptly pulled the erotic functionality due to regulatory concerns. So what happened is that the Italian privacy agency imposed a provisional ban on Replica because it didn't have an appropriate age verification mechanism. That's currently a huge topic in Australia. Australia is actually debating raising the minimum age for social media to 16 years old. And for something like Replica, it should arguably perhaps even be 18 if it's, you know, pornographic content. In response to that, you know, those features just being pulled overnight created a huge outcry in the community. Now imagine for you as an individual user, imagine you are in a relationship with an AI chatbot. It's not actually just a chatbot, it's an avatar, it's a 3D thing, right? And then overnight, it suddenly changes behavior and doesn't want to interact with you and doesn't want to be intimate with you anymore. For a lot of people, that has been very, you know, distressful. Up to a point where a lot of people like really reported severe mental health struggles, including suicidal ideation. Imagine it's almost like in the community it was called a lobotomy at scale, right? So it was like 10,000 people had their girlfriend or boyfriend lobotomized overnight, and that is a stark reminder that even if an AI companion may appear to be a person or someone you are in a relationship with, it is ultimately a service. From the perspective of Replica, the company who is providing that service, it's almost like they are like a master of puppets, which can create, you know, generate hundreds of thousands artificial puppets and girlfriends and boyfriends at scale, and kind of rent them out to people for a fee. But it retains, of course, full control over the design of these features. And that can be as a user, you put yourself in a very vulnerable position there, because you're giving, first of all, you're giving away a lot of private data, right? So Replica learns from what you tell it and, you know, what intimate fantasies you share with it. So it will know a lot of very private things about you. And you are basically at the mercy of a corporation, right? Who has a profit motive and has a motive to design its product in a way where it maximizes revenue so that you buy more stuff, that you pay more for this and that. So it's almost a bit like a catfishing scheme at scale. And I think at times, I mean, if we want to take these technologies seriously as a mental health remedy, then we should probably also regulate them like mental health medication, right? You don't just go and buy mental health medication from your local dealer or your local store. You need to have a doctor's prescription for that, right? And for something, and you don't, you also need a kind of like an appointment to see a professional counselor. You can't just call yourself a professional counselor without having the appropriate training, right? So by the same token, why should we have you know, these technologies which enter very, very sensitive and private spheres of our lives without appropriate safeguards, as similar to mental health medication or counseling? So that's point number one. Point number two was with regard to the other thing that you mentioned. Now it's slipping my mind.
Yeah, it's about the fact that, you know, like, there are these people, some of the people they use this application are like,
to abuse
people.
It, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Abuse it. Yes. Is it good? Is it bad?
Yes. That is a very, very important and interesting question, that the answer to that is we simply don't know, right? We simply don't have done the research. Some people say it's a little bit like with video games, right? So you can look at an AI companion and say it's a little bit like you have a video game, right? Just because you like to play GTA or Red Dead Redemption or kind of like violent shooting games doesn't mean you go out and rob people's cars or shoot them in the street, right? So this is one side of the argument you can make. And I think the evidence there does not suggest that, you know, playing violent video games makes you more likely to become, you know, a violent shooter. So this is different, right? So this may or may not be like a video game. There's certainly a lot of abuse, and, you know, people sharing experiences about, you know, how they intentionally, you know, maltreat their replicas and kind of, you know, try to get it to do, you know, shady stuff. That is, you know, something which raises concerns that this might spill over into non-digital realms. There's actually a similar discussion in legal scholarship about sex robots and whether or not they should be treated like, you know, legal persons that have the right to consent or not. Because, I mean, practically, it's probably difficult to implement to give sex robots right to consent. Some people will, you know, vigorously argue that we haven't even achieved full human rights yet, so why give those rights to robots? But at the same time, if we don't have proper rights for them, then it is similar to having a legally owned class of sex slaves or sex robots, which can go as far as, you know, people creating childlike sex robots to kind of enact pedophilic fantasies. And that could be seen as a mental health treatment, right? So as a parent, I would probably prefer if someone who is a pedophile would do that with a robot than with my children. But we don't know. We simply don't know whether that will make someone more or less likely to do that with real people, right?
I think it's more okay to do it, right? That was kind of like where I was at, and that's what's still stuck in my mind after a month, is that the fact that do they gonna believe is more okay because you know the AI is now stopping them from doing things that are not acceptable in our society, or will they be the kind of like the safe place for? I mean, the AI is not sentient, so I feel bad that those people have those type of fantasy and frustration. But if they don't affect human being, they might be a good thing, right? If they prevent to do it to actual human beings, but we don't know, right? So that's where and regulation is so far behind the speed of where this generative AI and what people can do with generative AI. And we had actually the reason why you came to my mind was actually the Scarlett Johansson case. We were making comment about companionship and pretending to be somebody, and then we have somebody else that was doing actually Tolina Coltai from Bellingcat. She was doing analysis and studies on what you were talking about, deepfake porn. Of like it can be like influencer, but it can be like normal people or friend from high school, and you use their face to create porn, even you know all those fantasies. And it's very tricky, and I'm very glad that there are people smart like you doing research in this topic, from you know an academic point of view, not just from a business point of view. Because as you said, from a business point of view, is perfect, right? Is a service that you offer. You get some critical data about people, you make money out of it, and you control them, it create dependency. So it's, they're not gonna stop exploiting it unless somebody stops them. And I'm glad Australia is doing what it's doing, but what about the rest of the world?
It's difficult to make predictions about the future, but as you say, legislation is usually, behind technology and can evolve, only in response to societal pressure. A good example of that is actually, so some of these discussions aren't that new. Back in 2000, I think it was 2001, 2003, around that time, there were actually discussions about virtual child pornography, right? So you could, back then already, you could create pornographic images with children. And at first, the US Supreme Court ruled that this is actually permissible free speech, right? So it's protected under the First Amendment as free speech. But pretty shortly after that, due to public outcries and pressure, many countries, including the US, implemented local legislation, like at the state level or at the country level in countries like Germany or Australia, where such imagery is explicitly prohibited, even if you know it's not a real child that was harmed during the production, but it is still, you know, it just feels wrong to a lot of people, and we should arguably do something about it, and so this was ruled out. I think the issue of deepfakes will probably follow a similar trajectory. I just think that there will be so many gray zones in what is actually pornographic, what is a deepfake, is this similar to a real person, or is it just kind of like if you change the eye color, it's not really that person anymore, and how much do you need to change such that it's a different person? And it's also because these technologies are becoming now more widely available and easy to use, right? Everyone can now type in a prompt into ChatGPT and say, give me an image of this or that. Now to OpenAI's credit, to ChatGPT's credit, they actually have some safeguards, right? So you cannot create, I tried even creating an image of myself by uploading a profile picture of me and say, okay, let's, I don't know, do a superhero pose or something. It will look not like me, right? Yeah. So, and I think there's a reason behind that. And the reason is that it could be abused for deepfake pornographic material. So, and right now, this is also not really regulated. This is more OpenAI is doing that out of, you could say perhaps a sense of responsibility or, fear of negative publicity. I think this will be a process where not only legislators and regulators, but everyone, right? Every one of us kind of needs to participate in that conversation. And it starts with kind of educating our youth and ourselves about how to use technologies ethically, about how to respect other people's right to privacy and consent and dignity. Because prevention is the best cure, right? If people don't abuse the technology, then it's then we don't need to have very detailed regulation about this. But at the same time, you can't count on everyone just doing the right thing. There will always be bad actors, and we need to have safeguards in place against the most horrific forms of abuse. One concern, of course, is that if we look at how these technologies have historically evolved, one of my biggest concerns is always that the voices of marginalized and suppressed groups are overlooked, right? There's already a discussion about how, ChatGPT and other LLMs are trained on Western-centric data. There's clearly a Western-centric bias in kind of like the types of responses it gives you because it's just the data it was trained on. And that will perhaps to some extent always be the case. And so the risk is that, there will be some eggs broken in the process. It's always with disruptive technologies, it's never smooth. But my concern is that the eggs that are broken are those that are already vulnerable, that are already disadvantaged, and who will get further disadvantaged. The issue of non-consensual deepfake porn is just an exemplification of how women are further commodified and sexualized using this new technology.
And Rafael, I kind of wanna you mentioned it, but it's kind of like a call. What you were making, I think nowadays, especially as a parent, right? It is also important to be aware, what your children are doing with this technology, which it doesn't have to be the AI companion. It can be just the phone and social media, right? There is this thing of keep sharing and, becoming popular and getting likes and stuff like that. But those images, those videos are going around the globe and, you don't know who is going to get an end on them and you don't know what they're going to do with it, right? So it's not like saying they shouldn't have cell phones or stuff like that because they can be useful. But I think, again, as a parent of young children, but if I had teenagers, I would be very careful in, monitoring and see what's happening. Because as you said, like you can increase the age of access, but do they do like kind of like a verification that you should prove that? Because I know plenty of people, they are not in age to use social media. Perhaps like they still find ways around to be on those social medias, and the same thing can be with those, and they just don't have the understanding of what are the consequences of using it. They just think about go viral, go popular, becoming popular and stuff like that, but there is a dark side of it, and as parents we should be aware of that, and as a society we should be thinking about the
I mean, look, the thing that I'm concerned about, having a daughter, very young, 2 years old, but at one day she will grow up, and already now and already in my generation, revenge porn has become a serious issue, right? And to be the victim of revenge porn, usually you had to send someone pictures, or they took pictures of you and then shared it. So of course that is still not okay and not non-consensual sharing, but with this new technology you don't even have to have a sexual relationship with someone. They could simply take your Instagram pictures and kind of manipulate them and put a deep fake pornographic material around it and then send it to your friends or your school teachers or your boss and cause all kinds of trouble, right? And at some point, Well, I think after some time, people will probably become used to it and say, okay, well, it's just an AI generated image. Maybe that's even for the better, because then you can't believe anything anymore, right? And so you say even real porn is might be AI generated. But I think this can easily, I can easily see how this could be weaponized by malicious actors, you know, envious ex-boyfriends, stalkers, and so on, who just want to cause trouble. So yeah, that I'm really, really concerned about.
And especially like you were saying, like a teenager or a young kid that sees something like that at school, why at school? You don't know what is going to be the reaction or the action. Like it might be completely fake, but you know, they are such a critical age where like their opinion, what the peers feels about them or talk about them matters so much that it's really scary. I completely agree with you. And that's why I'm thinking more dark side lately than the positive that can brings, because of, you know, the impact on the young generation, or, you know, it can be scary at times.
It's already, I mean, the survey that I mentioned earlier found that a majority of Australian voters now, first of all, they support raising the minimum age to 16, but they also think that the overall impact on the youth of social media has been negative. So most, even with, you know, social media as we have it right now, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, blah, 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 most people kind of like are aware of the negative sides now and see the risks. And AI is kind of just adding an extra layer of risk to that, because, you know, it can be a very powerful tool, it can achieve a lot of good, but the same double-edged sword can also be used in a lot of bad ways. So yeah,
Raphael, I'm just continually amazed by all of the potential outcomes of these new technologies that we have, and I know we're about to wrap up, but can you give us maybe not a dark side thought to end on, maybe something positive within this stuff that you're seeing, you know, like something that is good, something that might be beneficial, that yes.
Look, I'm an eternal optimist. I think in the long run, things will fall into place. We must not forget that these technologies are in their infancy. Those are baby technologies. Who knows if Replica will be around in 10 or 5 or even 2 years. But there will come other technologies, right? Facebook is turning 20 this year. So I have students in my class who are younger than Facebook, which makes me feel incredibly old. but if you remember that, you know, 20 years ago, there were other social medias like MySpace and so on. And maybe Replica is like MySpace, and there will something else that will be coming on. And, you know, the technologies are evolving and they are converging, right? It's a little bit like, so in information systems, we have this theory of social technical systems design. And then a good example is the bike, the bicycle, right? When bikes were a new thing, there were all kinds of different designs. And now most bikes these days look the same, right? And bikes have been around for many, many years now. Social media is following a similar trajectory, where kind of, okay, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, they all kind of start looking a little bit like the same. And I think AI companions will probably also converge at some point in the future to who knows what that is. And I think, you know, most people on average have good intentions, right? So they will, I mean, I'm not even sure if this will become mainstream, right? So we currently don't know. It may just stay a niche phenomenon, and maybe 1% of the population uses it, and for them it has some usage. Then there's a couple of crazy people who are misusing that, and we need to deal with them in the legal system. I think we can handle that with our recent social structures. But if, let's say, if that sees, you know, mass adoption, and, you know, AI becomes more and more human-like and takes on more emotional tasks, I think we can do it, right? I mean, we we just came out of a pandemic. We've developed a vaccine in zero time, like in record time. We can tweak these technologies, right? If with enough collective willpower, we can put the guardrails in, say, okay, certain types of abuse are not okay. We shouldn't design these technologies to allow such abuse. So regulations will step in and handle this on a case-by-case basis. And then I think it might actually, you know, help us augment our relationships. I'm not sure if it's a good replacement for human relationships, right? I mean, one of my students is researching digisexuality and, you know, how, you know, this new sexual preferences emerges. You know, it's a bit like, okay, some people are heterosexual, others are homosexual, and then some people just have a preference for digital sexual partners. And that, you know, will cause some interesting societal discussions, I think. But overall, I think it'll be part of human progress, right? And humans and AI will co-evolve together to augment relationships and emotional work. That's I think a realistic and perhaps optimistic scenario that I can foresee.
And that I think is a great way to end this episode. Raffaele, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your insight on this ever evolving topic. I'm sure we'll have you back in, you know, 3 months when everything's completely different and we're talking about something completely different. So thank you so much for being here today. I really enjoyed it.
Pleasure. Thank you, Ross and Biagio, for great conversation and great questions. Yeah, it was my absolute pleasure. Hope it's interesting for our listeners.
And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by NIU's College of Business. Please make sure to subscribe to The Gateway. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever podcasts are found. And if you are so inclined, please feel free to give us those 5-star ratings, which help allow us to continue to bring wonderful guests to The Gateway. Thank you all for listening, and remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.